brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
The things that I worried about in the terms of the pros, in terms of not being able to really help a professional basketball player or impact them, or that they didn't need teaching or they might not be coachable, all that kind of stuff was wrong. The players at our level need coaching, and they want coaching, and they appreciate coaching.
Nelson Taroba is the associate head coach and defensive coordinator for the Texas Legends, NBA G League affiliate of the Dallas Mavericks. He's been with the Legends since 2019. Taroba has coached at the professional level in both the United States and Canada for the Saskatchewan Rattlers, St. John Riptide, Erie Bayhawks, and Bakersfield Jam. Nelson is the founder of Hoops 101, a training-based organization that features summer basketball camps, advanced skills academies, and select teams. He previously served as the facility and basketball director for the Premier Athletic Complex in Leander, Texas. Taroba started his coaching career at the University of Texas, where he first served as a student manager and later became the special assistant to the head coach under Rick Barnes. He later served as the head boys basketball coach at his alma mater, Dripping Springs High School in Texas, and later was an assistant at Austin High School before getting an opportunity to move on to the professional ranks as a coach. Nelson has worked with both PGC Basketball and Snow Valley Basketball School in various capacities. Be sure to take some notes as you listen to this episode with Nelson Taroba, the associate head coach and defensive coordinator for the Texas Legends, NBA G League affiliate of the Dallas Mavericks. Hey, Hoopheads, this December, our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball are offering $1,000 off and two free basketballs with a Dr. Dish home purchase. Plus, all their commercial models are $2,500 off this month. Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. You can also check out their holiday gift guide if you're shopping for the ball player in your life.
Hi, everyone. This is Liz Kay, head girls basketball coach at Wacona High School in Dalton, Massachusetts, and you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Fast Draw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering Hoopheads listeners 15% off Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Just use the code HHP15 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improved communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its playbank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball. The first training camp Elite Skill Development and Performance Combine will be held on the campus of Western Reserve Academy, just outside of Cleveland, Ohio, powered by Unleash Potential and the Hoopheads podcast. The camp is designed for boys rising to grades 6 through 9 and will take place June 29th through July 1st, 2023. An emphasis on improving individual skills in the context of a team environment will be the hallmark of the training camp. Mike Klinzing from Head Start Basketball and the Hoopheads podcast and Joe's Decision from Unleashed Potential will serve as the camp directors of this inaugural training camp. Campers can expect 3 days of hard work, intense skill instruction, and learning how to be a great teammate on and off the court at the training camp. Players will participate in 10 elite skill development sessions led by some of the best coaches from across the country. Visit headstartbasketball.com to get registered. Be sure to take some notes as you listen to this episode with Nelson Taroba, the associate head coach and defensive coordinator for the Texas Legends, NBA G League affiliate of the Dallas Mavericks. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel tonight, and we are pleased to welcome Nelson Taroba, assistant coach for the Texas Legends of the NBA G League and affiliate of the Dallas Mavericks. Nelson, welcome to the Hoopheads pod.
Mike, really appreciate you and Jason having me. It's an honor to be here. I guess, you know, thanks to Coach Bonowitz, Coach Cook, Andre Cook. Those two guys were on before me. They're some local Austinites, Austin coaches who kind of probably spread my name to you. But it's an honor to speak, and hopefully we can help some folks and some coaches on the pod tonight.
Absolutely. Stan and Andre were two great guests. Both had nothing but great things to say about you. So looking forward to learning more about your career. Let's start by going back in time to when you were a kid. Tell us a little bit about your first exposure to the game of basketball, what that was like, what you remember.
You know, I've got to give my brother, my big brother, all the credit. I was thinking about this the other day. So my dad is from Cuba. My mom is from Colombia. All right. So grew up in a Spanish-speaking household. And the only reason I share that is just that we didn't kind of grow up with a generational kind of American approach to sports. So my kind of role model was my brother, because he was older than me. And so he started playing basketball when he was, my first, you know, recollection of basketball is probably when he was in the sixth grade, and I would have been in like the second or third grade, and I just go watch him play. We were at a private Catholic elementary school, St. Mary's, and he'd play, and I'd just go watch, and I, you know, was really intrigued by it. Of course, my big brother was, you know, who I looked up to, so I thought, you know, that's something I want to do too. So that's kind of my first interaction with the game personally, is watching my big brother play.
Chasing him around, how much do you feel like that had an influence on your love for the game and your competitiveness? Because I know that I never had a brother, so I only had a sister. So growing up and watching my friends who did have brothers, I always think of them just going at each other and competing at whatever it was that they were doing. How much of that do you think ended up having an influence on you as you got older in terms of your competitiveness?
To be honest, probably a lot, in the sense that my brother was always the best defender, you know, on the court. He always picked up full court. He always was just a pest on the ball. You know, really pressuring the ball, really disruptive, really annoying to anybody who was going up against him. Took charges, you know, did all the stuff, the dirty work. So again, that was my model. And honestly, so much of my basketball character and the way I appreciate and, you know, respect the quality of a player and how much they give to the game is just kind of still rooted in those starting points with him. You know, it's just defense first. I became a defensive player. You know, when I played, I took charges. I wanted to win in the margins, you know, and it's also, you know, spilled over into how I coach and how I, you know, kind of how I approach and the game and, you know, kind of that grit, I guess, about the game that I appreciate when I see.
When you're growing up with the game, was coaching something that you thought about while you were still playing the game? Was it something that you were always interested in, or was it something that came to you later on in life as you got into high school and college?
You know, I did always like, I liked playing, but I also liked the coaching piece of it. You know what I mean? I always liked just helping teammates, you know, like just giving them a tip here and there, that something I saw, or just executing the plan just the way coach wanted us to. You know, I was that coach's kind of, you know, almost like a coach's kid type approach, very much a pleaser with regard to, you know, making sure I did what coach wanted. So yeah, I think that's kind of how my approach was to the game.
You get an opportunity when you're at Texas as a student to work as a student manager with the basketball team under Coach Rick Barnes. Was that something that you went to school knowing that you wanted to do? Or is that something where you showed up on campus and they were looking for managers, or you talked to somebody? How did that process come to pass?
You know, I do want to answer that one. I want to say one thing though, one more about my childhood, just since we're
sure.
Probably moving to chapters here, but I do want to acknowledge, you know, that's my first recollection was watching my brother. But as I played, I'm going to give a shout out to, you know, one of my first youth coaches, which was Jim Gamage. He's a, you know, my friend Paul Gamage is a coach in the Austin area. His dad was kind of our fifth grade coach just years ago, you know, and it's funny. I want to make sure and shout him out because, you know, all of it kind of started there a little bit in terms of, you know, first organized basketball. I remember I hadn't scored a point like in, by the third or fourth game. You know, I was kind of like this, you know, just a little floor general, pass the ball, do all that, you know what I mean, all this stuff. I hadn't scored a point, and Coach Gamage was like, he, and I don't even, you know, I do remember this. I remember he tried to set a triple screen for me to just get a freaking bucket, right?
That's awesome.
And I still remember it, you know, and it didn't work, probably more from my lack of skill. But you know, it's just funny because, you know, I know you're doing, you know, youth coaching, you're doing the camps that you do, and you've devoted your life to the game, you know, and teaching the game the right way to youth. That, you know, what Jim Gamage did, you know, that would be, golly, I hate to say it, something like 38 years ago, or maybe 35 years ago, we'll call it. golly, that's tough to say. But anyways, about, we'll call it 35 years ago. What he did as a volunteer coach, you know, a dad who was did it the right way. He coached our summer league teams. He would open the gym, you know, on Sundays. We had, you know, open gym on Sundays growing up, you know, in the middle school, high school. That was always the most, like, you know, I would not miss an open gym on Sunday in Dripping Springs for anything. It was 2 to 4 p.m. every Sunday. And then during the summers, you know, we open up Monday, Tuesday, Thursday nights. So, but Jim Gamage was a coach, youth coach, but he was a guy like, you know, and I grew up in a small community, kind of outskirts of Austin, Texas. So back then it was small and kind of rural, like a small town, things that you don't get to see nowadays, but just, you know, our head coach, Coach Shelton, would give, you know, Jim Gamage the keys, and, you know, he would open up the gym on Sundays and just be, you know, old men and, you know, young guys trying to play together. And another thing I, you know, just you talked about the kind of grit and the character of the game and everything. I know that growing up and playing in those open gyms, and I mean, you may have Jason and Mike, you guys may probably have a similar situation maybe growing up. But, you know, what, some of the best lessons I learned growing up was from these old, grumpy old men, you know.
Absolutely.
They would just give you a look if you didn't feed them in the post and you took a stupid shot, right? They would bark at you and say, "Don't do that again. Pass me the ball."
Yeah.
And, you know, if you took a bad shot, they'd bark at you. If you didn't play defense or get back, they'd yell at you. You know what I mean? Like, and it was kind of like a nice way to learn about accountability within the game, not from a coach, but just from somebody who was like, no, we're not. That's not how you play the game. You know what I mean? Like, the game has standards. It doesn't have to come from a coach. You know, these old folks are kind of the protectors of the game, and they kind of in their own way kind of taught us a lot before we even had to get to coaches.
Yeah, it's so different than the way kids grow up today, right? Where from the time they're 6, 7, 8 years old, everything that they do is with a coach. Everything they do is with an adult. They're not on the playground. They're rarely on their driveway or at the playground. It's just I say all the time, Nelson, that I grew up in an era where if I wanted to play basketball, I went and played basketball, and I went and found a game. And when I was younger, it was in my driveway or riding my bike across neighborhoods to go and play one-on-one with my buddies. And then as I got older, I'd hop in the car and drive around the Cleveland area to find a pickup game, whether it was at a gym on a Tuesday night or it was at a playground on this day or whatever. You kind of knew where the players were going to be. And that pickup basketball scene was huge, and it was huge everywhere. And now you tell a kid that, hey, I was a pretty good high school player and college player, and I used to play basketball outside all the time. And now they look at you like you're crazy. Like, what do you mean play basketball outside? I mean, no, because nobody does it, right? Nobody does it anymore.
Nobody does it. And, you know, there's reasons why, obviously, I understand, you know, like why that, you know, from a liability perspective and all that kind of stuff, you can't do this, you can't do that, can't give keys out to just community members. And I've been a high school coach, obviously. So I know all these pieces, but I just know that, you know, not for the sake of just being, you know, the old guys that just pine over what was great, but just literally looking at it from just, you know, a neutral perspective of what we were able to get from the way, you know, the conditions were for us. You know, we were able, I think, to speak for myself, I suppose, but just able to make a choice to go play the game in an uncomfortable place. Like, in other words, I don't know who I'm going to be playing with here today. You know, it's pickup game. It's, you know, old guys, young guys learning about, I hate playing with that guy. He's selfish. You know, that guy's always fun to play with. He gets everybody involved. You know, that old man can barely move, but he makes himself useful, you know, by using his voice. You know, like you can just like there was a lot of lessons that we didn't even know we were learning that you can easily now I can easily like just go back and just catalog each one of those things very easily. You know, I think that's a big part of me growing up with the game is, you know, as I said, my parents weren't, generational athletes. They were just working all the time. So my choice to involve myself in basketball and to be a coach and everything with basketball and everything with sport and for my brother and me was always, it was all our own. You know what I mean? It was not, our parents had no influence over that at all. And, you know, they were supportive and, you know, all that stuff. I say it in a positive light, but I also think it was great that those were choices that were just made by me because I really love the game, you know? So,
yeah. And you don't see that as much anymore. I mean, a lot of what you have is parents driven in terms of, hey, you're going to go play this sport because kids can't just go out in the neighborhood and pick up a bat and a ball or pick up a football and toss it around or go shoot baskets at the neighbor's house. It's just not the way it is. Now, if you want to get a kid involved in a sport, you got to sign them up for this league or that lesson or this group. And it's just completely different. And I always say there's benefits to both ways. I can see, as you said, there's reasons why the game has shifted in the direction that it has. And there are certainly positives to both systems. I think the system that you and I grew up under and the system that we have today, I know just speaking personally from my own perspective, I'm so glad that I grew up in the era that I did because the basketball that I played with, as you described it, you know, the curmudgeonly old guys or the guys that would, when I was a 13, 14 year old, that would take mercy on me and pick me up for a game and then try to teach me how to play. And eventually as I got better and then I became a guy that people wanted to play with instead of a, you know, just a little kid that was hanging around trying to get into any game that I could. Like those moments and those different people that I got to meet of all different ages and backgrounds, like that stuff to me is invaluable. And I had some good moments as a player, as a high school player, as a college player, but a lot of my great memories when I think about the game of basketball, so many of my good memories aren't necessarily from those organized structured environments. I have just as many good memories from the pickup basketball, both in terms of the people I met and just the idea of hanging out at the courts and being there for 2, 3, 4 hours and coming home so tired from running up and down on the pavement. Like those memories to me can never be replaced.
No, 100%. And so, you know, that is, you know, I kind of wanted to mention those type of folks and that part of, you know, my upbringing with the game. You know, and of course my, you know, played through middle school, high school there, Dripping Springs High School. You know, one of the reasons I got into coaching, you know, and I have to give my high school coaches, you know, some credit as well. Coach Shelton was my varsity coach. Coach Henry was my JV coach. My first, you know, middle school coach was Coach McDaniel. But these guys, you know, again, I can see it now. But you know, one thing I can easily see now that maybe some coaches get wrong, you know, because we have so much access to information now. You know, you know how to run a pistol or, you know, a two-sided break or, you know, peel switch. I mean, you know, there's so much stuff that everybody can have access to. So coaches are more informed. But I'll say this about Coach Shelton, my varsity coach, is just I always had fun playing. I always felt prepared. I felt like he did a great job of not really bogging us down with too much of the details of the opponent, really kind of focusing on what we were doing. Which is as I've kind of grown and matured over time, like I have a kind of a respect for the discipline to be able to just, you know, pick and choose and just really narrow our focus and just focus on ourselves more. But he was really a great high school coach. It was enjoyable. You know, he didn't scream and yell. He was a calm, but, you know, controlled and stern coach, but like he didn't feel uneasy. He never hardly raised his voice, told you what we were going to do. explained it clearly, calmly. He redirected, you know, when we didn't do it right. And so, I think that's something that you know, we talk about coaches and stuff like that, that's just great, great coaching when you have enough command over the content and enough command over yourself that you can still run a tight ship, but not have to scream and yell to do it all the time. You know, I think that's pretty noble. So I want to, acknowledge that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think when you look at what anyone does as a coach, there's so much influence, right, on the early coaches that you had in your career, especially when you think about yourself as a young coach where you don't have very much experience. I know that, just speaking again from my own perspective, that when I first started coaching, basically everything that I knew as a coach came from my high school coach mm-hmm. and my college coach. And that's kind of what you do mm-hmm. until you either A, learn that, hey, there's other things out there that I can do and I better learn and educate myself about the game. And it's funny, we were talking in our previous interview with Tom Harrington from Buckeye High School. And I just said, I thought I knew more at age 22 when I got my very first coaching job than I do now at age 52. I'm way less knowledgeable today about the game than I was at age 22, because again, coming off of a playing career, you think, man, I know pretty much everything there is to know about this game. And I think there's some ego involved, and you kind of get yourself into this position where you think, man, I know everything there is to know about the game. And as you get into it longer, obviously, you know that there's so many things that you can never learn enough. Let's put it that way. There's always somebody out there that's innovating and trying something new, and the game is evolving. And so as a coach, I think that's one of the things that when you look back and hearing you talk about the guys that coached you when you were a player, when you were a young guy, and the influence that they had on you, I think that those are really important influences. I'm sure they were for you moving through your career.
They were. And so, so that's kind of the, and the last thing I'll say, why coaching? And you kind of mentioned, when I played, did I have an interest in coaching? And, as I kept playing and, being on teams, I definitely did, kind of think about it. Our senior year, we had a really good team. We were district champs. We lost in our first round playoff game. We thought we'd, win state like every other high school kid. But I love that team. Like that team, obviously still good friends with people on that team, but I love that team and just the connection we had. Just as there's just something about what we do and being on a team, and I don't know how to explain it to folks who aren't on them, but it's just something special. So that really stuck out to me in terms of something I always want to be a part of. But, I went to school. I went to University of Texas. You mentioned, kind of getting into that, but I enrolled in the University of Texas and I got into the business school, because everybody I talked to said, you're too smart to get, to be a teacher and a coach. You're not going to make enough money doing that. It's a waste of, say your brain or whatever.
Get a business degree and you can do whatever you can do just about anything with a business degree.
Yeah. Right. So I thought the same way. But as I got to University of Texas, there was actually the girls coach at Dripping Springs, who was very successful. His name was Coach English. A very good coach. And so it's interesting that I was shooting in the gym after school one day, as a graduated senior. And then his office had a window that, looked down into, or just looked out into the court. It was, first floor. And he called me, he kind of came out and said, "Hey, you got a second, Nelson?" I said, "Sure." Went and talked to him. And he said, "Hey, have you ever thought about coaching?" And I said, "Yeah, actually, I have, coach." He says, "Well, I just think if you ever thought about it, I think you'd be a really good coach." And he just said that based on, I guess, watching me play or watching me, even on the bench or just the way I carried myself in pickup. Who knows what he thought he saw. But, that's him saying that to me was big in the sense it just made me think. And I was a very respected coach, not even my own coach, but just for him to take the time to just say that to me was, it stood out?
You know, my first experience coaching was, you know, when I went to the University of Texas as a freshman, first year in college. My old high school coach, Coach Shelton, asked me if I would be the middle school off-season basketball coach. So that entailed kind of coming to the school every day, something like 2 to 4 p.m. And I just ran the entire, you know, middle school off-season program. So, you know, something that was neat for me, just, you know, when I was at school, in school as a middle schooler in that same school district, it was smaller. So as a young player that didn't play football, you know, we never had an option that was a basketball off-season. So for me, it was a really cool thing to be able to actually just kind of give something to players that were just basketball only players in the great state of Texas, which is so football oriented, that, you know, that connected with me because I knew that that's something I wish I had when I was in middle school. So I did that for 2 years. And then we talked about kind of how I got to the University of Texas, I think, from there. And so what had happened is Coach English, who was the basketball coach who had kind of first reached out to me when I was a senior and kind of encouraged me to think about coaching, he was running a basketball camp that summer. And I attended and coached it and helped him out there. But as part of that camp, he had a, you know, daily end of camp message relating to not, you know, not putting off your dreams and your hopes for another day if you can help it, you know, resonated with me. So I ended up, I had been reading a book called A March to Madness by John Feinstein, which was a season chronicling the ACC for a season. And so he spent time with North Carolina, Duke, you know, Clemson. So I remember reading a chapter about Clemson with Coach Barnes when he was at Clemson. And I just, you know, the way they portrayed Coach Barnes, just resonated with me. And I was excited for him to be at the University of Texas. They had just hired him that spring. So Coach English's message at the camp really kind of, lit a fire under me, I guess. And I just went home that day and wrote a letter to Coach Barnes, at the University of Texas. And I just wrote a letter, just said, hey, I don't know, you know, I don't know how I could, but I would just like to find a way to be involved, just to observe practice. I'll work for free, you know, sweep the floors. Doesn't matter to me. I just want to be part of the program and learn. You know, it's a dream of mine to be a division. Back then, my dream was to be a Division I basketball coach. And to be the dream was to be the head coach at the University of Texas. So that's kind of how I wrote that letter. And then, you know, as I said before, you know, about 4 days later, at my home, there was a message on the answering machine, blinking red light, and I hit the button. And as I said before, we didn't have voicemail back then, no cell phones. So, you know, you got the messages at the house. But I hit the button and I played the message. And it was, you know, Coach Catala, assistant coach from the University of Texas. Ed Catala, he said, Coach Barnes read your letter. We'd love you to come in, work summer camp. And right when I heard the message, I played it four times. I literally kind of sprinted around the house two or three times, I think, out of excitement. And so that's kind of that's the beginning of how I got involved at University of Texas. I ended up, you know, working summer camp. And that was the first step in kind of becoming a student manager.
What was your relationship like with the coaches on staff as a manager? I know we've talked to a number of guys who have gotten into coaching through the manager route, and a lot of them have different experiences in terms of how much access they had with coaches, how much time they spent talking with the guys on the staff versus kind of just interacting and doing their tasks. Like, what was your relationship like with the staff?
You know, again, this is kind of like a big shout out podcast. I do want to acknowledge Coach Catala, you know, in particular, because, you know, what I learned later, and this is not to disrespect, you know, the process or Coach Barnes anyway, but like what I learned later is Coach Barnes probably never did read that letter. it was just Coach Catala had read that letter as the assistant coach and, you know, liked, you know, he knew the kind of person or the kind of, you know, whatever that he wanted to kind of, you know, he was in charge of the managers. So he knew what he wanted. And so then that's, you know, that was my first trial. So, I would not be speaking to you today. I wouldn't have had a chance at the University of Texas and kind of got, you know, accelerated on my path there if it wasn't for Coach Cutala, just for whatever reasons, finding that interest in my letter. But you talk about connections on staff. You know, that was great for me. I mean, Coach Cutala was a good mentor for me. There was a coach there, Russell Springman, who is now at Oral Roberts. And he was a young coach who was kind of a graduate assistant or, you know, special assistant. He was very instrumental in me, kind of, you know, as a mentor to me. Got involved with summer camp there, and he kind of eventually, you know, put me in charge of summer camp when I was, you know, first graduating from being a manager. So Russell Springman was a big mentor for me at that time. And, you know, you're right. I mean, just connecting with the coaches, Coach Cousins was great. He was, you know, kind of a prankster, but, you know, was fun. And lastly, you know, my second, you know, toward the end of my tenure there as a manager, Rob Lanier, Coach Lanier, came in as an assistant, and he was great. Coach Lanier, Todd Wright, the strength and conditioning coach, was a big mentor as well, and he ended up, he's now with the Los Angeles Clippers, I think, is kind of their strength and performance director. So he's in the NBA. But Coach Lanier, who's here at SMU in Dallas now, he was a big mentor for me as well. So, yeah, it's a lot of time with those coaches, just spending time with them was real instrumental for me growing up.
So you mentioned earlier that ultimately at this point in your career, your goal is to be a Division I college head coach. And so as you start looking around, as you're coming to the end of your time in college, you're about ready to graduate, what are you thinking about in terms of your next step when you want to get into coaching? I know you go and then you become the special assistant to Coach Barnes there at Texas, but what's the process like? What are you starting to do to sort of plan out and map out what the next steps are going to be in your career?
Yeah, you know what it is that, first of all, I switched over from the business school, which I mentioned earlier. Now I switched over to education. And I became a journalism major. And because I kind of thought if it didn't work out with basketball, I would like to write about it or cover it on TV or something. So I was a journalism major, history minor, and getting my teaching certificate. So basically, as my managerhood was kind of expiring and I was head manager and all that stuff, I kind of had another semester. I kind of was just trying to stretch it out. You know what I mean? Yep. I kind of wanted to,
right, I
didn't really want to leave.
Who wants to leave college, Nelson? Come on, man.
I know, man.
Nobody
know,
does. My daughter went to college this year for the first time. So she's a freshman. So she's just about finishing up her first semester. And, you know, I've been down now to visit her a time or two, whatever. And you kind of, you know, she's talking about her schedule and what she's doing every day and this and that. And I'm like, man, can I go back? I want to go back to college again. And my son, who's a junior in high school, he's like, Dad, he's like, Meredith, she doesn't really have much to do, does she? She's got a lot of free time down there. Meanwhile, he's got like 7 high school classes and he's playing on the mm-hmm. basketball team. He's doing a million things, you mm-hmm. know, and she's like wandering around campus doing, you know, who knows what. So yeah, I can understand why you might want to stay.
You know, and it's funny, but when you're in college, I mean, when we were in college, I didn't even think that we had that much time.
No, you didn't process it that way at all.
Oh, you're so, no, you have no clue. I wanted to get my teaching certificate and, you know, do my student teaching. So I stretched it out another, you know, year and semester. And then Coach Lanier was really instrumental. He ended up moving on to Siena. He's, you know, and kind of on his way. But I helped. Coach Lanier was very, what do I want to say, kind of a visionary. And what I mean by that is, when he was there, he started recruiting TJ Ford to the University of Texas. And I remember him telling me, you know, if we get TJ Ford to come to the University of Texas, all the other big players in Texas will come here. And so I helped him with that. And I would help, you know, I was a magazine journalism guy. So, you know, I would help him with some creative stuff on Photoshop. And we were doing stuff like Built Ford Tough and magazine covers with TJ Ford and, you know, all that kind of stuff. Kind of before that was being done, you know, that was kind of, he was, you know, ahead of the game a little bit.
Right.
So I think, you know, my work in the office, and, you know, I would go in, I would help with mail outs. I would help with, you know, back then we'd have mail outs and we'd have, you know, the handwritten, you know, the stuff, we'd stuff the envelopes and we'd send that out to all the recruits. So, you know, I would do that. That's kind of what I would do as a manager. I'd go into the office and I'd help with recruiting mail outs. And I started saying, hey, I could help with, you know, doing some other stuff. And so I got involved with that. So I think that, as Coach Denier left, was moving on to his head coaching job, there was a spot there. He ended up really going to bat for me and Todd Wright as well. And said, you know, Nelson should get, you know, he's a guy who would be a good guy to bring on as a, I guess, on staff as a special assistant. So that's kind of how I got my start from moving from manager over to being on staff.
What was that transition like in terms of the relationship with Coach Barnes?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the story is not like a fairy tale necessarily. And I say the truth because I know it helps coaches. You know what I mean? There's a lot of young coaches out there that aspire to be in big places.
Yep.
And you know, why not? Right. I get it. I think my relationship with Coach Barnes was distant and respectful in the sense that he's just like, he was a very imposing figure. You know what I mean? He was a great coach. You know what I mean? He, you know, really intense. And he was nice off the court and, you know, and welcoming, but I didn't have like a tight connection with Coach Barnes. It was more like I was more connected to the assistants.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Sense.
And I was yep. more like, you know, yes, sir. Of course. You know, you mean say like, right. you know, how the head coach is, you know what I mean? Like, it's scary. Like, the
yep,
head coach
exactly.
is scary back
that's
then.
Scary.
It still
yep.
is. Like,
that
some
is scary.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's okay. Like, head coach should be that way, right? I think it should be like, there's just like this, I don't know, separation there where you're like, okay, that's, you know, that's the head coach. Let me push things through the assistants. The assistants take care of all that stuff. So I didn't have a close connection with Coach Barnes per se. It wasn't adversarial or anything. It just wasn't, you know, really close. So I did that for a year. I was in charge of summer camp, did video exchange. Back then we had VHS. I would, you know, send out FedEx envelopes and we would actually exchange VHS tapes, which people nowadays don't even have an idea about.
No idea what that was like.
Yeah, no, we got Huddle now. We can just, you know, do whatever we need. It's amazing, right? But I had to do that. So that's what I did. I did summer camp. I helped with other stuff, the recruiting stuff as well, the mail outs. So that was kind of my role. And so what happened at University of Texas is that, Coach Lanier went away, some new coaches came in and, you know, it's a lesson I learned. So I think that it's important to understand, you know, for all coaches, especially coaches aspiring to move up, you really need advocates. You know what I mean? Like, you need coaches who are up in those rooms right there next to that big dog who are singing your praises when the big dog has no idea what you're doing. You know, because there's too many things going on in a program, right? Sometimes for the head coach to know what everyone is contributing. So I had some really good assistants that were helpful up to that point. But when Coach Lanier left, that affected some of that. And, you know, long story short, you know, after 1 year as a special assistant, Coach Barnes, you know, said, hey, listen, we're kind of doing a budget cut. And this position's not going to exist. And I say this, you know, I'm just being real transparent. I think he got some information about me. There was a perception that, you know, that I wasn't working as hard or that I wasn't as committed as I once was. And I, you know, I tell you guys this and your whole audience, and it really was, there was no change in me, but, I remember Coach Barnes talking to me once on a plane and saying, you know, you don't understand, Nelson. In this business, perception is reality.
Yep.
Yeah. And I said, I said, you know, Mr. Whatever, I just said, no, Coach, reality is reality. which, you know, advice to the young coaches out there, just say yes, sir.
Just say yes. Just say
yeah,
right.
Yeah. Yeah. Just, yeah, yeah, Coach, I got you. So I just, I think that there was a perception there that I wasn't doing what I had once done, and that trickled its way to the top. Again, I share the story with your audience because it's not a perfect story, you know? So basically at the age of what, say 22, I was young, maybe 23 at this point. You know, my dream was to coach at the University of Texas. I had a little piece of paper in my dorm room that typed it out. I will coach basketball at the University of Texas, you know, and I know in a sense I got to do that. I was just a special assistant, but I was on staff and it was a dream. But at 23, 24, now, you know, I was no longer a coach at the University of Texas. You know, my job wasn't there. In a sense, I was fired, from that job. So that was the first time in my life that I felt professional failure, you know? And that was a dream dashed, right? University of Texas, Division I, you know, I had to kind of pull myself off the mat. One thing that I always appreciated, and it kind of, you know, we're talking to coaches and everything else, it kind of shapes the way I am now as a coach still to this day, is that I never felt that when I was told I wouldn't be brought back, I didn't feel like I got specific, you know, feedback about what it was that I hadn't done right. Right. So even as I talked to Coach Barnes, I said, well, Coach, tell me whatever it is I haven't done well. Okay. Anything, whatever it is I haven't done well, I'll fix it. I'll fix it right away and you'll never have to correct me again. You know what I mean? And he really couldn't think of anything. You know what I mean? And it was just like, well, we're just going a different direction. And that always stuck out to me. And it's, you know, it still shapes me today as a coach, is I never ask a player or a staff member or anyone else. I know how important, you know, like I affect their future. You know what I mean? So they have a dream. Doesn't mean that I'm going to help, you know, I'm not going to be the guarantee of their dream, but I always want to make sure if I'm telling somebody or if somebody's doing something that they're not, that's going to prevent them from attaining what they want, I don't have a problem telling them that, you know, like, listen, if you don't do this, you just got to understand you're an assistant coach. If you don't clean up this video situation, you need to know that this is the type of thing that will affect your ability to be retained. You know, you may get fired for this. This will affect your future. You need to correct this or else it can affect you. You know what I mean? And I'm going to tell you exactly what you need to correct. You need to be on time. You need to communicate ahead of time. You need to do this. I am very, very committed to giving people direct, clear feedback about anything that could prevent them from getting what they want.
Yeah, it's really important. I think that it's a theme that's run through a lot of our conversations with coaches when you talk about having those brutally honest conversations, whether it's amongst yourselves with your staff, whether it's with players. I think in my own personal experience, I know that when you're in a situation where you have to have a difficult conversation, if you try to put that off or you try to sugarcoat it or maybe soften the blow, you often end up doing a lot more damage than just coming out and saying what the truth is and what the situation is. Because so often when you don't have the truth out there, then you have this sort of nebulous empty space that gets filled up with a lot of stuff that's not true, that ends up being toxic all the way around. And I think that's something that a lot of young coaches, and I know I can speak for myself as a young person, I think those were conversations that I probably wasn't very good at. And I don't know that I'm great at them today, but I do know that in any situation where I've tried to push off the truth, it hasn't turned out the best. You're much better off having that conversation right up front, as you said. And then ultimately, when all the information, when all the cards are on the table, then everybody can figure out, okay, here's where we're at. Now, what do we do about it? And everybody can go about it from the same starting point. Whereas if one side has the truth and the other side doesn't, that just doesn't work.
Yeah. And I think, you know, somebody might listen to this podcast, and I'll tell another story about me getting fired from high school. So it's a miracle that I'm talking to you here, since I got fired from the University of Texas and my high school, my own hometown. And the reason I share those stories is because it's something I tell people that are young coaches. I said, listen, I hope you never get fired. Okay. But I hope also that you do get fired when you're young. Because when you get fired, you know, you're like, what in the world am I going to do? How can I survive this? You know what I mean? And I was, you know, 24 after I kind of pulled myself off the mat there. One last piece about this, since I'm, you know, you guys, it's like my therapy session, it sounds like, right?
That's good. But that's what we're here for.
No, but I mean, I always want to acknowledge people. So Leslie Parks, who was the administrative assistant, you know, kind of Coach Barnes' secretary there, got fired. You know, Coach called me in the office, got fired. I really didn't see it coming. I just got done with camp. I'd done a good job. You know, the back then, DeLoss Dodds was the athletic director for the University of Texas. His grandson, Stefan, had attended camp. And, you know, DeLoss Dodds came up to me after the camp and said, this is the most organized, best camp we've been to here at the University of Texas. Great job, you know. And so I just felt like, you know, I felt like I'd done what my job had asked me to do and everything. I felt good. But then, you know, I got surprised. And so there I go. So I remember I left the office with Coach Barnes, and I'm thinking, like, who else in this office knows I'm fired? You know, does everybody know? Do I? Right, am I right. The only one? Right? Like, because you just like, and you,
right, people out, you know, yeah, they're looking at you side-eyed, right?
Right. And what do I do? Do I clean out my office right now? I don't even know. So, and I, to that point, my blueprint had been, do, you know, work your rear end off, right? And do right by people, right? And, you know, as I said, I didn't know anybody going anywhere. I didn't have any connections. I just did, you know, just worked hard and did things for the right reasons, I thought, and that moved me up. So that was kind of like a big gut punch, you know, make me think, like, I guess that doesn't work, you know, all the time in my head, right? I know now that does work, and that sometimes you can do all that, just like a player can do all that. And sometimes it's a numbers game. Sometimes there's some things beyond our control. It's a fit situation. And when you're young as a player or a coach, you just, this idea of fit doesn't ever come into the equation. You think it's just about kind of, you know, just do right or do it the right way. And that's always part of it. You have to do that. But you also learn over time that you have to be in a place that's a good fit, that, you know, you, what you do, they value, and what, you know, what your leadership values is what you, you know, you're about. So I say that to say, I, you know, put myself off the mat. Leslie Parks, I'm all kind of messed up, you know, in my office trying to figure out what to do. Call my brother, tell him, man, you know, I'm in tears, you know, I mean, it's the first time I've been fired. You know, I come back in the office and kind of slink into the office. and Leslie, you know, to her credit, I always appreciate this. She came into the office, my office. You know, I was kind of getting some things, and she just said, you know, hey, you know, we tried with Coach. We told him all the stuff you do behind the scenes. But, you know, sometimes when Coach gets something in his head, you know, it's just, it's hard to kind of change his mind. But again, the reason I share that story with you all is because I always make sure that if somebody's done a nice job And this happens all the time in our industry, and they get let go, or it's a player who's done a nice job and they get cut. And sometimes it's beyond their control, you know, and they did everything they should do and they did it well. I always know how important it is to, you know, look that person in the eye and say, you know what? You did a really good job. You did what you needed to do here. This is just something that's beyond your timing, you know? And that made a big deal to me with Leslie doing that. And you know, I still do it to this day, but I share those two stories because in a weird way, those really bad kind of traumatic things, being fired and all that stuff, just really shaped me into the type of coach and, you know, leader I wanted to be. I wanted to be real. I didn't fear any longer the uncomfortable conversation, right? Because I knew the alternative to that was they wouldn't know, and then they would end up losing their job anyways or losing their position that they wanted. So I just knew in my head, like, and that's how I tell them. I said, listen, I'd rather just tell you, because you're either going to lose this thing in 6 months and you knew how it was going to come to you, or you're going to be surprised, and I'd rather you not be surprised, you know? So that's, you know, I left from University of Texas and went back to my hometown, Dripping Springs. I decided that I just wanted to be a high school coach. You know, I was still about the game, the purity of the game. I said, you know what? You know, I think I'm a better fit in high school. I can just focus on teaching, you know, and focus on just being about the game. And, you know, so that's how I went back to Dripping Springs, which is my hometown.
United Basketball Plus is your doorway to all things basketball. If you desire to go further, faster as a coach and leader, if you want to maximize your team's potential, or if you simply just want to be a student of basketball, United Basketball Plus is the resource to take you to the next level in your basketball journey. As a member, you will have access to some of the greatest minds in basketball today. The in-depth videos provided by these coaches and basketball experts will help make difficult concepts simple to understand and teach. With your membership, you will have access to video playbooks, sports psychology, fast model playbooks, skill development, speed agility, and various other United Basketball Clinic videos. Your annual membership also includes access to our 2021 United Basketball Clinics, as well as discounts to attend future basketball clinics. The best way to find out all we have to offer is to visit us at unitedbasketballplus.com.
So how prepared do you feel you were to take that job and be back at your alma mater? I'm sure any coach that I've ever talked to that coaches at their alma mater has a special feel. It's just, again, one more layer on top of just the job itself is the ability to be back in your hometown and to be able to represent a program that you went through. I mean, coaches take a lot of pride in that. So how do you feel? How prepared were you when you took that job? And just tell us a little bit about what it was like coaching at your alma mater.
Yeah, I mean, the two dream jobs that I had were to work at the University of Texas, right? And the second, once that one extinguished, the second dream job I had would be to be the head, you know, varsity coach at my old high school. So I got to do, the good news was that I got to do both by the time I was 26. You know, the bad news is they were both in my rearview mirror by the time I was 28. when I went back to Drippin, I was there 2 years in the middle school. Enjoyed it. You know, I was 2 years as a freshman coach, really enjoyed it. Had really good seasons as a freshman coach. So the answer to your question, how prepared was I? As prepared as I could be, but still young, you know, and was going to make mistakes just like anyone else, you know, but, I think that I was prepared. And I worked hard to try to be prepared. I was a freshman coach, had really good seasons, like 30-2, 28-4, something like that. And I thought I was really, you know, you talked about earlier, like how you know, when you're young, you really think you got it, you know? And I thought, man, I'm a pretty good basketball coach. But what I didn't recognize was, like, I was a freshman coach coaching against was usually in Texas, you know, the football coach who they put in as the freshman basketball coach. You know, so I'm a basketball dude, just all about basketball, who's constantly coaching against guys who you know, some were good coaches, but a lot of them were just like football coaches who that was their assignment to just kind of their second sport, right? So I move up to be the varsity coach, and I'm sure we're going to win 20 games, you know, at least my first year. We're definitely going to make the playoffs. And I think we were 8-12.
That was 20 wins.
Oh man, 8-12 made me worse. I really don't even remember. It's probably for my own health that I never kind of registered those records. I know it was 8 wins. Maybe it was even 8-14. But I remember like we started up 0-2, 0-3, and I, you know, and then my confidence turned into like, oh my gosh, I'm looking at the schedule. I mean, when are we going to win one? But great learning and it was fantastic because by the time, you know, I got to my freshman, my, you know, district season, you know, we play each team twice. I'm sure y'all do the same. Man, those old ball coaches just whipped me. You know what I mean? They were playing chess. I was playing checkers for sure. I mean, I learned so much. I probably learned more in my first year of varsity head coaching, you know, just from getting beat and out schemed and just out coached, than any other year probably in coaching. But it was good. And luckily, I was committed to trying to get it right. And, you know, I think the first round of district, we were 1-4. And the second round of district, we were 4-1, you know, against the same teams. But I learned a lot, you know. And so the second year, I think we were just a couple games over 500, my second year there at Dripping Springs. And we had a talented player. And he was young, young player. We butted heads. I know this is a lesson I would share with any coach. You know, I didn't know how to do it any differently. You know, I was standing up for the team. I felt that the player was selfish, a little immature. I wasn't wrong to assess that. But what I didn't do is I didn't find creative ways to hold him accountable. And it became more about, you know, barking at him, running and sprinting, you know, punishments. And I think it became like a distraction to the process of the team, as opposed to, you know, finding a way to get him, you know, to on the right track, but do it in a more collaborative or, you know, inclusive way. So after my second year, long story short, at Dripping Springs, I was told in the summer by my AD, you know, we're going in a different direction, which was also, you know, a big letdown for me. And, you know, here I am at, I guess, 28 at this point, probably. And now I've lost my second dream job. And in my head, I'm like, you know, is this really for me? Yeah, you know,
I could see that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, because, and the reason I say it is I love the game and I love coaching, teaching, but the part that my heart was broken, you know, because in my head and heart, I was like, I knew that I really cared, you know, about doing a good job. I knew I really cared about the people too. It wasn't just about my ego. You know what I mean? I knew that I was working hard, doing my very best. You know what I mean? And I thought if I could work as hard as I can and have noble intentions and be in my own hometown, you know what I mean, where I grew up and played, and I could still get fired from there, right? I thought, I mean, can I survive?
Yeah, how am I ever going to have job security, right?
Right, right. So that was tough. And so I ended up, it was a quick turnaround. So I ended up landing at Austin High, which is a school in the area. I was assistant. And my first year there at Austin High, freshman, was kind of like a shell of myself, just kind of trying to recapture my coach's voice. But as I, you know, this is something for coaches that are there and listening, you know, if you've been fired, if you're down, you know, like it's just totally natural, it's totally normal. And I just remember it, you know, the first phase of it was like, man, I've been wronged. I got fired for the wrong reasons, all that kind of stuff. But after, you know, reflecting, I remember I read a book. It was something about total transformation or something like that. It was something like that. What it was about, you know, it was a parenting book. And it was about, you know, parenting, you know, quote, tricky kids or whatever the phrase might be, right? I remember reading it, and that was a really good book for me because it really taught me that, listen, you just have to focus on the behaviors, you know, de-emotionalize things, right? If they're not blocking out, you know, I could make them run sprints, or I could say, no, do that again. Do it this way. You know what I mean? Let me show you like this. Do it. And then they'll do it and say, perfect. That's what I needed you to do. They don't do it. Nope. Do it again. Nope. Do it again. Perfect. That's exactly what we want. We're moving on. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I know that's just learning how to correct, give feedback the right way, but force behavior change the right way. Just simply by being able to clearly articulate what you want is so important in coaching. And I finally got over myself enough to say I wasn't, you know, I didn't have bad intentions at Dripping Springs. I didn't have bad intentions when I was coaching that player. I did want what the best for him. And he ended up, you know, going off in college, and he ended up, you know, 12 years later, reaching out to me and saying, you know, just texting and saying, hey, coach, listen, I just wanted to let you know. And it meant a lot, you know, but he reached out and said, I wanted to let you know that I know that in high school, you really did have my best interests at heart, you know, and that, there were some conditions going on beyond your control, that I really couldn't, I wasn't mature enough to handle, you know. I went off to college and it was like you said it would be, you know, they redshirted him. They sold him, you know, a bill of goods. They redshirted him and he ended up transferring, but it was really, you know, cool that years later that he reached out and made sure to say that to me. But the takeaway I would give coaches is this, which is, you know, it's really easy to be a coach for the loyal soldiers who do exactly as you say before you even tell them to do it, you know? It's fun to coach those players, no doubt. But I thought to myself, if I'm wanting to be a great teacher, you know, not just a great coach, a great teacher in the classroom, a great teacher and a great coach, the great teachers always find a way to connect with a great majority of the students, and especially the tricky ones who are those really brilliant students who are just not being challenged enough. They find a way, right, to engage those students. And I thought, if I want to be considered a good coach, I have to be able to connect with the most talented players who have the most personality. That's my job. That's my duty. Otherwise, I'm just an average coach. So I flipped my mentality about kind of from the victim thing to just saying, like, I've got to learn how to really be a better coach if I want to be doing this and be consider myself a good coach. So that became with learning how to deal with behavior change and giving better feedback. That was a big thing for me.
Yeah. And that's definitely where you earn your money, right? And when you start talking about working with guys that have talent, but that maybe are a little bit more difficult to reach or a little bit more temperamental or whatever it may be, I think if you can get to those people, it's the same way, like you said, as a teacher, you know, everybody likes to work with the student who's sitting in the front row and always has their hand up to answer a question. But the reality is that not all the students are like that. And not all the players are the ones that are the coachable ones, the ones that you wish you could have 15 of them. You need a lot of those, but you're also going to, in your career, you're going to deal with guys who aren't as easy to work with. And if you can figure out a way to to connect with them, to build relationships with them, and then to be able to have an impact on them on and off the basketball floor like that. That's really where you're, that's really where you're going to make your, you know, make your mark and have an impact on people.
Yeah. And I think, in the, you know, the more you do it, you realize that these, you know, folks that have, you know, more challenging to work with, they also have had sometimes more challenging upbringings, you know, and yep. more challenging circumstances. And, you know, you gotta have to learn about folks, you know, learn about people, learn their story, understand them better, you know. And, you know, you would look at, you know, a lot of people wonder, like, they look, you know, I'm associate head coach with Texas Legends, G League coach, been a professional coach, you know, we can get to on all that, how that came to be. But the truth of it is, no part of me ever wanted to be a professional basketball coach. Like, I didn't want to be, like, in terms of a pro, I want to be a Division I college, but then I want to be a high school coach. I did not want to be a pro coach. I thought if I was in the pros, number one, these guys aren't coachable. Number two, what would I be able to, you know, provide them as a coach? You know, I didn't play at this level. You know, what could I offer them? You know what I mean? And thirdly, you know, out of ignorance, I felt that, you know, I'm watching a game, it's just isolation basketball. There's just no coaching going on. You know, it's the pro, you know, all that stuff. And, and I was wrong, you know. So I learned that, you know, I couldn't coach where I coach now, and I couldn't coach the way I coach now if I hadn't fallen flat on my face in my 20s and had to really kind of reassess how I wanted to approach working with players, you know. And I'm glad I'm glad it all worked out. But, you know, that's kind of the way it is. And so, you know, I did Austin High for a year, 3 years, actually. I was at Austin High, and I got my confidence back, you know. Was helping out with a team there. It was a very tough, good district. My head coach, Coach Dudney, really, you know, gave me a voice, kind of, he was great for me in terms of just trusting me to kind of give me a nudge in the back. Cause I was a little, you know, still a little, you know, a shadow of myself. He was great for me. And then by the time my third year happened there, we had really good players. We had a really good season, 29-3, I believe. Got to the quarterfinals in state, won a playoff game, all kind of things that, and won some tough games against good coaches. And I was really involved in all that. Really gave me confidence, you know, that I could think on the same level as some really good coaches in a high level, you know, of high school basketball. And so I was there and, you know, was still an assistant, had a great season. But, you know, Will Voigt, who was a special assistant alongside me at the University of Texas, he had gone, his route was he went professional. I went high school. We always kept in contact. We were friends. And he just reached out. We always kept in contact. And he said, hey, would you have any interest in coming out and being, you know, like video guy and a third assistant here with the Bakersfield Jam? If I had been a head coach of my own high school team, I wouldn't have done it. You know, I would have already had my program. And I wouldn't have left for that. But I couldn't get another head high school job right away because I tried once or twice. And I said, you know what, let me go do this for a year because I could at least learn. And if I come back, it'll look better if I have, you know, some pro coaching on my resume. Maybe I can go get the head, you know, head varsity job in town that I'm trying to get. So I went to Bakersfield. That's how I started kind of as a pro coach. That was in 2011.
Did finances play at all into that decision?
Well, yeah, but not in the way you think.
No, I'm assuming in a negative way.
Yes, it did. So listen, that's a good question. So it was in a negative way. It wasn't terrible, but what happened, and this is kind of what's allowed me to kind of just meander through this path a little bit, is that I ended up, my house that I bought when I first graduated from the University of Texas, I just put it up for rent, you know? So I put it up for rent in Austin. And so I went to Bakersfield so that the house gave me a little bit of extra income. And the pay was good enough, but the house gave me enough extra income just to kind of survive if I didn't have anything else. And so that was kind of a help. And so then I went and did it. And I also enrolled in graduate school, remotely because I wanted to study how to be a principal. So I got my master's online. I told myself, I'm going to make this kind of a win-win. If the basketball pro thing is terrible, I'm going to use this time to kind of work on my master's degree at the same time. So I'll come back from this and I'll be better off. You know, I'll be able to either pivot into administration or I will, you know, maybe something works with this pro coaching thing. So I did it. And so the house being rented was helpful in that financial situation.
Yeah, I'm sure that made a big difference. What's that experience like when you go? Obviously, you're going up to the professional level. It's a different animal. It's a different experience. You got, you know, coaches that are working in the pro game. You got players who are obviously trying to make it and get themselves to the point where they can make a real payday and be able to make a career out of it, make a go of it. So just tell us a little bit about what's that experience like in minor league basketball here in the United States? Because I think it's an area that, you know, we've talked to a couple different people on the podcast that, you know, have had experience in that area. But I think it's not even a lot of basketball fans, coaches, I don't think they necessarily have a good understanding of what it's all about.
Yeah. So what I, you know, the things that I worried about in the terms of the pros, in terms of not being able to, you know, really help a professional basketball player or impact them, or that they didn't need teaching or they might not be coachable. All that kind of stuff was wrong. You know, the players at our level need coaching and they want coaching and they appreciate coaching. You know what I mean? They want to be the best in the world. You know what I mean? So they know that if you can help them be better at what they love and what their dream is, it doesn't matter how tall you are. It doesn't matter how loud you are. You know, it doesn't hurt if you're tall. And it doesn't hurt if you have a great playing background. Doesn't hurt. Does not hurt. You have a lot of built-in cachet, but that cachet will wear off if you are not competent, and if you are not on top of your game, prepared every day. You know. So as far as the pro game, what I learned when I went to Bakersfield was, you know, that I could coach those players. That those players were receptive to coaching. And that I actually enjoyed the level of thought and play, you know, that was going on. And I enjoyed it. So I wanted to come back, you know, but again, story of my career there, there was not a spot for me, you know, the second year at Bakersfield. So I came back to Austin and, you know, I helped kind of open up a facility in Austin and oversaw that facility, the PAC, the Premier Athletic Complex, built out programs there, AAU training, new facility, you know, six courts, you know, the whole thing. Started out basketball director, was the facility director before, you know, within a year. Good job, good paying job, lots of autonomy, lots of creativity, enjoyed it. But, you know, I just kind of, about 4 years in, it's funny how it works. You know, I'm coaching a group. There's a player named Curry Flowers. And Curry is a player who just tells the truth. All right. And he doesn't have a filter and he just tells the truth. We fast forward to the end of the year. Curry ends up getting a scholarship to Temple Junior College to go to school after his senior year. He says, "Hey, coach, you mind taking me to school to move in?" His mom was working. I said, "Yeah, I don't mind at all." It was about an hour up the road, so it wasn't a big long trip. So we're in the car, and Curry kind of looks at me and says, "Coach, what are you doing coaching AAU basketball at the PAC? and you know, like, No other player in my life that I've coached would have had the wherewithal, the courage, right, the moxie to even ask that, right? And no other player would I have taken it the way I took it when Curry asked me, you know, which was, I took it as the biggest compliment on earth, right? Because he was not easy, right? He was the type of player that I couldn't keep my job with when I was at Dripping Springs. You know what I mean? He was, you know, that tricky player. He's emotional, but he loves the game, plays hard, but he wants you to be good at your job. He wants you to put him in positions to be successful. You know, he wants you to help him win the game. He cares about the game, you know, and if you're not helping him win the game, he doesn't mind telling you that you're not helping him win the game. But Curry says that to me. He's like, Coach, you can't be doing this. You gotta be in a college somewhere else, the pros, what, I don't know, but you are not an AAU basketball coach, you know, for the Pack. And I laughed, and, you know, this kind of goes back to like the Coach English, you know, little moment in time where somebody kind of tells you something that makes you think, you know, it stops you in your tracks a little bit more than the normal everyday deal. And, I didn't do anything about it, but it just registered in my head. Like, yeah, I just laughed. I said, yeah, you're probably right, Curry. You know, this is, I said, but I like this, you know, I like this. It's good. You know, I get to, you know, whatever. He's like, and he just looked at me like I was crazy. Right. He's like, whatever, Coach, you know, you're crazy. Like, you know, you need to get somewhere else or something. So that's that. We dropped him off. I worked Snow Valley Camp, you know, which I had started, in 2000, I think 2001 was my first year working Snow Valley Camp out in California. So I always worked it every year. I always loved it because I learned really good coaching teachers there. That was like probably the biggest, you know, developer of me as a coach was working Snow Valley basketball camps. Learning from unbelievable coaches, seeing what it was like to like run a defensive clinic like six times, teach 6 hours of defense over a week.
Yep.
I just knew drills, you know? And going there, I was like, wow. And I went there a couple of years and I was like, wow, this is crazy. These coaches like know how to teach these subjects like they're teachers, you know, like classroom teachers.
Right.
They are teaching basketball, you know, not like, and that was like so cool. My notes. I mean, I would just, my legal pads full of notes every time I went to Snow Valley. And another one of the formative people in my life as a coach was Coach Sands, who was, you know, the lead, the director of Snow Valley in California and Santa Barbara, Montecito. He was an older coach, great coach, great man. And even though it was just a summer camp, you know, and I'd go every summer, those coaches like looked after me, you know, they mentored me, they cared, and they really modeled great teaching. Learned so much at Snow Valley. But I remember you talk about formative things. One of the things that really helped me find my voice as a coach, you know, when I was still at, in Dripping Springs, as Coach Sands, that was like my second or third year at Snow Valley, and he saw me writing all these notes. He saw how much I cared, and I, whatever that clinician taught, man, I go to my basket. It was exactly how that clinician taught it, you know, using the same words, same progressions, you know, organizing it the right way, taking pride in really bringing that to life. And I loved just the learning. I was like, because I know if I learn this, I do it right, I'm going to learn it myself. And he came to me and he said, he knew me well enough to know that, you know, I probably would say no, but he said, I want you to coach the defense, teach defense next year at Snow Valley. And I, I flat out said, Coach, I can't do that. <That's> I was serious. It wasn't false humility. It was like, I looked at it, I said, Coach, there are so many good coaches here. I am not in their ballpark. You know, there's so many better coaches to teach defense here, you know, and to his credit, you know, like Coach English did and Coach Sands did it to me. Curry Flowers did it for me. some people just sometimes just kind of grab you by the shoulders figuratively and just shake you, you know, like, wake up, man, you know. And he said, I'm not taking no for an answer. I'm giving you a full year to prepare, you know. And if you want to be great, you got to get out of your comfort zone. And, you know, so I did it the next year. I don't know, you know, if you know about Snow Valley.
Been to Snow Valley in Iowa multiple times now with Coach Sho and Coach Slaw there. So those guys in Iowa do a tremendous job. I haven't been to California, but definitely have been, you know, part of Snow Valley is an important part of what we've done here with the Hoopheads Pod. I mean, Coach Showalter, the podcast wouldn't be nearly where it is without him.
Well, so, you know, then, so, and I worked with Coach Sho one summer there in Iowa too. And it was amazing, you know, very, very awesome. The coaching is great. But like, you know, California is where it all started.
Right. In the 60s.
And so that's, you know, Jeff Van Gundy, the Van Gundys came up through Snow Valley, Greg Popovich, John Wooden, Rick Majerus, you know, all kind of coaches came up through Snow Valley, you know? And so it was just very intimidating. You know, so, you know, when I started to do my defensive clinics, it's literally like if you're a performer at Carnegie Hall, you know, it's like, that's a big deal. You know what I mean? Like if you've been around for a while, you see these coaches and how good they are. You get these great coaches teaching. So I taught defense, and I remember I was trying to do the SOS defensive system, Bob Kloppenberg, you know, up the line, you know, trap the box, everything just super aggressive, full denial, you know, and did it, you know, did a good job teaching the drills, you know. But as they started to play, man, we were giving up layups. The rotations were so long, rebounds, putbacks. You already know what I'm talking about. Like, I was all spread out defensively. I had no idea what shrink the floor meant or anything about it. Gap defense, not a clue. I thought it was all about aggressiveness and going and getting it and everything else. And against Snow Valley helped me. So I did it. I worked hard. And I thought to myself, this is in some old coaches were, you know, in my group, and you know, like, hey, have you ever seen the DVD Mike Heideman, the Pack defense? Mike Heideman, Wisconsin, Green Bay. Okay. Great. I mean, coaches out there, that's a great teaching DVD on how to teach defense. So they told me about it. Yeah, this is pack line. You should think about it. You know, they were probably just being nice to me. Like, you are just giving up the paint left and right. And, you know, I went and watched that video. And then that really helped me become a better defensive coach. But what Coach Sands knew he was doing for me is Snow Valley made me plant my feet and say, this is defense. This is offense for me, you know. And that's the hardest part as a coach, is planting your feet and defining your philosophy, you know what I mean, and your belief set. And that was what was so great about Snow Valley, is I did that and I got to get a chance to like improve my system. Every year he let me teach and tinker and learn from others. And that's probably the best reason that I'm a good – if I am a good teacher of the game – it would be because of Snow Valley.
Well, it's a process, right? Same way with a player, that you can't cheat the process of becoming a good coach. You can't cheat the process of becoming a good player. There are steps and there are things that you have to do in order to get to the point where you can be the type of coach / teacher that you're talking about, to be able to grasp all those different subtleties of the game. And then let's face it, the most important part of being able to coach, what's the old saying? It's like, it's not what you know, it's what you can get the players to do. It's what you can get them to actually learn. And it's one thing to have a bunch of knowledge in your head. It's another thing to be able to be out on a basketball court with a bunch of players and get them to execute what it is that you're trying to teach them, whether that be an individual skill or whether that be something team oriented. And I think your story and most coaches' stories is that that doesn't happen automatically. It doesn't happen overnight. It doesn't happen without a tremendous amount of time and effort of you putting that into the game so that you could be at your best and be prepared as these different opportunities throughout your career have come at you.
Yeah. And I think that that's what's great, you know, and I, you know, to kind of accelerate through the, you know, the next, you know, kind of the pro piece is when I got back to what folks should know, young coaches and all folks that are interested is, you know, I got a chance to go to Bakersfield and work with Will Voigt and start my pro career. Mostly because I was kind to Will Voigt when there was a lot of conflict at the University of Texas. You know what I mean? And I was just, you know, a good person. You know what I mean? Like, and he knew that about me. You know what I mean? And he knew that he could trust me. You know, he knew who I was, right? We worked alongside. He knew that I was committed to the game. I wanted to be a great teacher. That I was a truthful person, you know, that I wanted to do right by the game. He knew that. And he also knew that I was willing to take tough stands and not always go with what everyone else thought. You know what I mean? So anyways, my point is because I was kind in myself and just, you know, kind to him at a time when we were both kind of in flux, when he got that opportunity, he wanted someone like me, you know, to be on his staff. So that got me a chance. And as we fast forward to when I got back to Austin, I didn't have anything at Bakersfield. I worked PGC, Point Guard College, and Chad Sanji, you know, was a director. He helped me, you know, connect with Tony and Leslie Puckett, who were the owners of this new facility coming up in Austin. And I became basketball director there, kind of took a sabbatical, traveled to the Midwest, you know, traveled around watching good coaches, but then ran basketball there for those 4 years. When I wanted to get back into the pros, I go back to Snow Valley, right? After Curry Flowers tells me, coach, you're crazy to be coaching, you know, AU, I go back to Snow Valley every year. I did it, even though I wasn't, you know, a full-time coach. I always went because I enjoyed it. And I was coaching basketball, defense or whatever. And, you know, coaches came up to me like, hey, where do you coach at, coach? And I was like, oh, you know, facility here in Austin, Texas, you know, and they're like, oh man, we thought you were for sure a pro coach the way you know, you have command or whatever they said, you know, it was a compliment and whatever. And again, it just started just tapping me on the shoulder again, Curry's comment, these coaches' comments. And I said, you know, I just got to try again. I just gave it one more chance. So I ended up reaching out Erie Bayhawks. The general manager for the Erie Bayhawks was George Rodman. George Rodman had been a camp counselor, okay, when I ran camps at the University of Texas. He was in charge of the buses, put him in charge of the buses. and then I recommended him to be a manager because he worked hard and he was sharp and good sense of humor. George Rodman is now like in the front office in Charlotte with the Hornets, but he was with, he became a San Antonio Spurs, you know, intern, moved his way up, whatever. And he ended up being a general manager at Erie. I was like, oh man, I reached out to him, this and that, you know, if you guys ever have, you know, something open up, I just got this itch and, you know, whatever. Says, you know what? We actually do have a spot opening up. I think you'd be good for it. You know, start assistant video. Again, a guy that knew me to be a good guy. If I was like abusing my power, you know, when I was in charge of camp, if I was, you know, treating people the wrong way, he was on the low end of that totem pole, you know? And it's funny because he gave me a chance in a sense to get to Erie. The only person on my resume list that Coach Peterson, Bill Peterson knew, who was the head coach at Erie, was still his choice to hire me or not. He looked at my resume and the only person he knew on my resume was Dave Bullwinkle. I don't know if you've worked with
Dave. Yeah, I worked with Dave 2-3 summers ago. Yep.
Right. It's Snow, right? So yep. So I worked with Coach Bullwinkle since 2001 at Snow Valley, California. He ran the point guards, right? So I was working with him several years, and Coach Bullwinkle's the best. And he's always been a great mentor to me, even since then, still to this day. And that was the name that Coach Peterson knew on my list of references. So Snow Valley, you know, I never wanted to be a pro coach, but Snow Valley and my work there as a high school coach helped me get back in as a pro coach, you know. And Bill George Rodman helped me get back in when he was just a manager, aspiring manager, when I was running Texas basketball camps. And Will Boyd helped me get a chance at Bakersfield when we were both alongside each other as special assistants. And then I fast forward to that, and you know, I end up being at Erie. I go to Canada for 2 years. Our team runs out of money, of all things. Welcome to, you know, minor league pro sports.
There you go. That story has been told before for sure.
Yeah. So that happens. And I reach out, and George Galanopoulos, who's the head coach of the Legends, he had been an intern at the Bakersfield Jam when I was a third assistant. So he was 23. I was 33. In a sense, I mentored him a little bit back in that time as he was getting his start. And lo and behold, the basketball world and the pathways that happened, George got named the head coach of the Texas Legends. You know, he worked his way through the Dallas Mavs player development, you know, department, video department, and, you know, got a chance to be named this head coach. And when I called him, I said, hey, listen, man, this team's run out of money. I don't know if you hear anything. And his staff was already full, I was pretty sure. I said, but if you hear anything, and then gee, just let me know. He's like, you know what? There's a chance. There's a spot here that's going to open up. I said, okay. So again, lo and behold, George hires me to be his, you know, assistant, you know, run the defense for a couple of years and all that stuff. But again, this last chapter of my life, right, of my coaching life in the pros, is all based on relationships that I formed before this chapter ever existed, fully not knowing that I'd ever need those relationships or that I'd ever even want to be in the pros. And all those folks that were actually below me on the totem pole kind of pulled me up when I was down, and, you know, they moved up faster than me. And they were kind enough to give me opportunities, you know, when they moved up. So it's really interesting how it's all worked out.
Yeah. That's a lesson that I think that if I could teach a young person, I try to have these conversations with my own kids a lot, that you've got to invest in people and you've got to treat people the right way. And when you do that, then you start to build relationships. And look, a lot of the relationships that you or I probably had when we were 20, 21, 22, you know, those people that we had relationships with that were our friends, probably at that time couldn't really do much to help us because they're not in positions to make decisions. But as you get older, those friends that you make when you're 17, 18, 20, 22, 23, now those people get to a point where they can start to make some decisions that can help you. And that, and if you've built that social network, it's just so important. I think it's underrated. I look back at the early part of just not even my career, but just my life. And you kind of wish that, hey, I should have spent more time building a network of people that could have been there to support me when I wanted to try X or wanted to try Y or was looking for this. And, you know, again, that's not to say that what I did didn't work well for me and I didn't end up where I was supposed to end up. But I do think that there's so much value, as you said, in relationships, and your story really does a great job of illustrating how important those relationships can be, because ultimately there's a lot of people that want to be basketball coaches, and there's a lot of people that want to coach at the Division I college level. There's a lot of people that want to coach at the professional level. And the more people that you know that you've had a working relationship with that can talk about the quality of the person you are and the quality of work that you do, that's going to put you in a position to be able to get one of those jobs that's coveted by a lot of people. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. And I'll say this too, you know, just on that note is, again, this is not something I ever aspired to. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. I have to say that again. Like, I didn't aspire to be a professional basketball coach. I aspired to be a college coach, and then I aspired to be a high school coach. And I'm glad that it went in all the orders that it went through, because I say this to people too, like, the pro coach, like where I'm at now, the pro coach could learn from the high school coach, because the high school coach does not get to replace their players. They don't get to trade anybody. They don't get to release anybody, and they don't get to sign anybody new, and they don't get to recruit anybody. They get what they get, and they make the most of it. Right? And absolutely, that's their job. And that's the most noble thing. I love high school coaches. Like, it to me is the most noble profession. I love it because it is about that, you know, like, you got to take what is given to you and make it into something, right? So I think that pro coach could learn from that, you know, because sometimes with pro coaches and people in college would be like, hey, you need to give me better players. You
right.
know? The front office isn't doing their job. The assistant coaches need to get better players. You guys, you know, got bad recruits. We need to get on the road, get better players, you know? So number one, but number two, the high school coach and the college coaches could learn from the pro coaches in terms of using terminology effectively, organizing their systems efficiently, using practice time purposefully, not wasting a second, you know, not a drill that doesn't connect directly to the game. No, just drills that I like, you know, just everything. You know what I mean? Like, you got,
I know exactly. I love this drill. I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah.
Everybody's got their favorites.
Yeah. Let's go. Okay. 12 minutes on the clock. Let's do favorite drill, you know, and you know, you can't do that in the pros. Cause like, nope, we don't want to waste those 12 minutes. Cause we only get 90 to 120 minutes. And after that, we need to preserve their bodies. They're going to look at us like we're crazy if we're wasting their time, you know. And the other part about the pros that I really appreciate is I have to earn the respect of my players every day, every single day. If I come in one day of practice not prepared and a player asks me a question, or they're like, yo, we can't. No, we can't do it that way, because if you do that, he's going to pop for three, and now that's not going to work. In the pros, they just tell you that. You know what I mean? They say, no, he's going to pop that, and we're going to give up a three. And they'll just tell you, right?
Yep.
And you're like, so you have to do the work every day, and I have to come in every day really prepared, because you can't fake it with pros. You can't fake your knowledge. You can't fake your command over the curriculum. You can't fake your voice, and you can't fake your authenticity, and you don't need to yell, and that doesn't work either. You have to teach. You have to correct. You have to do it calmly, and you have to do it consistently, and you have to earn the respect. And it's a slow process that I always have to do every year. But it's one of the things that I really appreciate about the pros is that I don't get anything given to me here. I have to come to work every day and earn it. Because if I don't, they'll just tell me that doesn't make sense, coach.
Yeah, it's a great point. I think that's something that it speaks to any level. When you're doing your prep work for a practice, or when you're doing your, you know, you're drawing up a practice plan, or you're putting together an offensive set or a scheme, or you're working defensively on rotations or whatever it is, I think one of the worst things that you can do as a coach is to come in and be unprepared. I think, and that goes to any level, right? I mean, even if you're talking about, you're standing in front of a group of middle school kids, and if you're trying to explain an out of bounds play and you say, well, go here. Oh, you got to go there. You know, and you're talking like that to them. Those kids are going to quickly lose respect for you. And now you take that to the pro level and you're multiplying that by, you know, multiples of 100, where they're going to look at you and be like, hey, this guy's not prepared. He doesn't know what he's talking about. And I'm sure that in those cases, you'd get tuned out really, really fast. Let's put it that way.
You do. And that's what I'm saying. Like, you know, in middle school, the players have to be like, okay, yes, sir, coach, we got you. In high school, Oh, yes, sir, coach, we got you. In college, okay, even less now because now they got the transfer portal, right, and they got NIL, so, which I think is great. The coaches have to earn the players' respect every day, you know, and they can't sell you. I can't sell you a bill of goods and say, you're going to come here, you're going to play, you're going to play 40 minutes, you're going to be the best in the world, we're going to treat you right. And all of a sudden you change the second somebody steps on campus, you change your tune, and all of a sudden these players are trapped because they, oh, I don't want to sit out a year. I think it's great, you know, because coaches need to earn the players' respect. And that's what I think, you know, in those areas, sometimes you're granted positional respect, but in the pros, it's not that way. And you have to earn it through your competence. And that's what I appreciate about the pros. It makes it challenging every day, but it's also, I know when, you know, I earn that respect if I do, when I'm able to, with every, you know, any player that I work with, I know what it looks like and feels like. I know when it happens that's a noble undertaking, and that's something that had to be very intentional and it didn't happen by accident.
What's your process for learning and growing? Where do you go? Who do you talk to? Is it mentors? Is it books? Is it film work? What do you do to improve your craft as a coach?
Yeah, I think it's film work. Yes, it's always, you know, talk with others. It's, you know, working camp, you know, still I'll try to get a Snow Valley in here and there. I'd love to visit other coaches. You know, it's learning from other coaches, really, always. So sometimes it's, you know, in all truth, you know, for instance, I'm in the G League, you know, the coach at Memphis, Memphis Hustle is a great coach, you know, coach against him several years now, scout against him. I like to do that scout, you know, cause I'm always learning that, oh man, he used him that yep. way. That's really good. So I still to this day, the most learning I get is from other coaches and great coaches, you know, studying their teams, seeing how they utilize the personnel, how they conduct themselves, you know, that's the best learning for me.
What's special about the G League?
I think what's special about the G League is it's a humble league, meaning the people here haven't arrived at their final aspiration. Okay. Now this is a lofty league and it's a great league on its own, right? It's got good coaches. It's got great players. Like this is a tough league. You know, some people say it's the second best league in the world, you know? What makes the G League special is it's filled with great players, with great coaches, but with a lot of people who are on the rise that are using this opportunity and this podium to springboard them into what they want. But it's a humble league, and everybody here hasn't arrived, so there's not a lot of entitlement. There's nothing like that. There's like, We gotta get to work here because we all want to be, you know, a level higher than where we're at. So I think the best part of the G League is the amount of learning, the amount of development, and the whole thing is built around that model. It's about around development, and it's around really great players playing against really good players, but all really focused on developing so that they can get that one last developmental stage completed, so they can get to where they really want to get to.
All right, we are coming on past an hour and a half, so I want to ask one final two-part question. Part one, when you look ahead over the next year or two, what do you see as being the biggest challenge in front of you? And number two, when you think about what you get to do each and every day, what about your job brings you the most joy? So your biggest challenge and then your biggest joy.
Well, the biggest challenge is for the young coaches out there. It's the same as me is the biggest challenge is being able to, you know, the G League is great, you know, lasting job security, you know, biggest challenge is job security. And that's just a true statement. You know, you don't know where you're going to be, you know, maybe from one year to another, because the G League is very, nomadic in a sense, you know, because they're always trying to bring new people in. So the biggest challenge for me personally is just making sure I land somewhere, whether it's here or elsewhere, where I could just get that stability, you know, long term, you know, 3-5 years, you know, some sort of stability where you know where you're going to be. I think that's the biggest challenge. The biggest joy in coaching is the same joy that I had when I was playing for Dripping Springs High School. It's being part of the team, coaching staff, and helping players, man, like just helping them see what they can do before they even know they can get to it. You know, helping a player realize, you know, you're a parent, so you can kind of, you know, like you can see these things your kids are probably missing out on, you know, like that they're just not seeing, you know. Your daughter, she's in college, she's in her friend, you know, she doesn't realize all this free time she's got, yep, all these opportunities she's got. You know, like we can see the things because we've been there. Right? We can see that the gaps, we can see all this stuff. So it's great to be able to share your experience with a player who's got great talent, got a great mind, got great aspirations, great work ethic, that you can help them plug some of these gaps that they don't even know are there, that you can help them with. And that those little areas are the difference between them reaching their aspirations and not. And for you to be able to kind of find a way to bring those to life, to teach them in a way where they'll receive it and they'll understand it so that they can apply it and then use all this God-given talent, skill that they have, and mind power to get what they want, you know? So just being able to help people realize, you know, their potential, I guess, but to do it in a way where, you know, you give them a gift, I guess, that they can take with them. And I guess it goes, you know, I guess I'll wrap it up with, you know, when my mom, you know, I was in high school, I got some scholarship, you know, as a senior, some scholarship, leadership scholarship or something. And, you know, I came back to the table. I didn't expect I was going to get it, you know, some kind of banquet and everything. It was kind of a surprise deal. And so I got it and I come back to the table and my mom's crying. I'm like, Mom, what is wrong with you right now? You know, and she's crying and my pops is just, you know, beaming. And, you know, again, you just got to know that these, you know, again, they came from different countries, right? Cuba, Colombia. And it's the most important thing that my mother always said that she was just at the top of her mind was always that we would be able to get an education. And the reason it was so important for her is because my dad and my mom, you know, didn't have, say, quote, formal education, but they were very smart, very hardworking, very industrious people. But they always felt like they had to work twice as hard because they didn't have the starting points of education, you know, to get where they wanted. And one thing that stood out to me is my mom's crying and she's doing her thing. And you know, she just, it never connected until that time for me, that dot didn't connect where she was just like, we've done everything we could to make sure you guys had the opportunity to learn. You know, they moved us to good places and, you know, they made money so that they could put us in good schools. But it was all about making sure we had a good education. And one thing she always says is, you know, no one can take education away from you. And that's what I think about in terms of what's the best part of our job, you know, as coaches and teachers, is if we can teach somebody some things that they can take with them, they're forever theirs. And that's the best part of doing what we do.
It's well said, Nelson. I think being able to do what you do, to be able to share with players, to be able to put the time in, to increase your own knowledge base so that then you can pass that along to the players that you get to work with and have an impact on them, both on the basketball floor and hopefully helping them to advance in their career and get to where they want to go and reach their goals. but you're not only helping them on the floor, but you're helping them off the floor. And really that's what it comes down to. Coaching, yeah, wins and losses, critical, important things we're all judged upon. But the reality is that the impact that you have on as a coach goes way beyond those wins and losses. And to be able to impact people by sharing that knowledge and giving them something that, as you said, and as your mom so eloquently said, that it can't be taken away from them. And there's power in that for sure. Before we get out, I want to give you a chance to share how people can reach out to you, find out more about what you're doing, find out more about the Legends. If you want to share social media, email, whatever you feel comfortable with. And then after you do that, I'll jump back in and wrap things up.
Sure. I mean, anyone can reach out. You know, I'm on Twitter, I guess, at Coach Taroba, you know, C-O-A-C-H, Coach. The last name is Taroba, T-E-R-R-O-B-A, all one word. You know, that's Twitter. You know, that's probably the best way. I mean, I'm on Instagram, too. I'm not very exciting on there. Definitely not an influencer. at least on Instagram, I prefer to be an influencer elsewhere. But that is, you know, that's an easy way to get a hold of me. You know, I'm always happy to help coaches who are just trying to improve.
Nelson, cannot thank you enough for taking the time out of your schedule. And although many of you out there listening will not hopefully notice, we had a few technical issues that Nelson stuck with. He stuck with us throughout the course of the technical issue. So again, thank you. We really, truly appreciate it. And to everyone out there who's a part of our audience and listening, we appreciate you as well. And we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks. Your first impression is everything when applying for a new coaching job. A professional coaching portfolio is the tool that highlights your coaching achievements and philosophies. And most of all, helps separate you and your abilities from the other applicants. The Coaching Portfolio Guide is an instructional membership-based website that helps you develop a personalized portfolio. Each section of the Portfolio Guide provides detailed instructions on how to organize your portfolio in a professional manner. The guide also provides sample documents for each section of your portfolio that you can copy, modify, and add to your personal portfolio. As a Hoopheads Pod listener, you can get your Coaching Portfolio Guide for just $25. Visit coachingportfolioguide.com/hoopheads to learn more.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads Podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.